Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation tonight. My name is Jen Dodd. I'm the Q2C Festival Programming Manager here at Perimeter Institute. A very warm welcome to everyone joining us here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and also to everyone participating from around the world. This lecture is part of the Q2C lecture series presented by KPMG. These events would not be possible without their generous support of this festival, and so we would like to extend our warm thanks to KPMG for that. Before we begin the lecture, I would like to ask you to turn off your BlackBerries and phones, just in case. Now, please allow me to introduce your speaker for this event. Sean Carroll is Senior Research Associate in Physics at the California Institute of Technology. His research ranges from cosmology to field theory to particle physics to gravitation. He is the author of an upcoming book called From Eternity to Here, which I'm really looking forward to. It's about cosmology and the arrow of time. You can also find his writings on the blog that he co-authors, Cosmic Variance. Tonight he's here to tell us about time and its connection to the beginning of the universe. So please join with me in welcoming Sean Carroll.
Thanks, Jen. And I also, before even starting, I just wanted to thank the Perimeter Institute for putting on this fantastic festival, all 10 days of it, and we're just at the beginning, but it's already clear this is a great thing for Waterloo, a great thing for Canada, a great thing for science, and a great thing for the world. So thanks to Perimeter very much for doing this. And so the theme of the festival is quantum to cosmos. The theme of my talk in particular I like to think of as kitchen to cosmos. I will be talking about quantum a little bit, but what I really want to get across is the idea that in our everyday lives, in the days that we go through and the things we experience in the world around us, we are actually feeling the effects of the much larger universe in which we live. In particular, what happens to us in our kitchens, the fact that we can take an egg and turn it into an omelet, but it's very hard to take an omelet and turn it back into an egg, is a remnant of the fact that we live after the Big Bang. And the Big Bang was a very special event. So what's going on here is, as you see, the arrow of time, the fact that time has a direction, the fact that we all agree on the difference between yesterday and tomorrow, as far as we know, everywhere in the universe that we can observe, we have the same feeling for which day is yesterday, which day will be tomorrow. And that's something that shows up in our everyday lives, that helps us get to the festival events on time and so forth. But it turns out that there's a profound mystery lurking here. There's a lot about the arrow of time the physicists do understand, but there's one very important thing that they don't understand, and that's the origin of it all. It turns out that the reason why yesterday is different from tomorrow is because the day before yesterday was different than yesterday. And that's because the day before yesterday was different than that, and you can go all the way back, 14 billion years, to the Big Bang. The fact that you can take an egg and make an omelet, but not an omelet and make an egg, is because of the Big Bang. That's the message I want to get across in this talk today. But let's start with thinking about time more generally. We all know about time. We use it to meet friends at the right moment. We use it to get to work on time. We judge our lives by it. But there's different aspects to it. When you start talking about defining time, you get into trouble very quickly because we use the same word to mean different things. So I just want to separate out two important notions of time. One is that things repeat themselves. Things are predictable in nature. They happen over and over again in a way that you can be confident is going to be the same every time. You can't even say these sentences without using the word time some way or another. You know that the sun is going to rise in the east every single day. It might be foggy, you might not be able to see it, but it's going to happen. That's a repetitive synchronization, and that's what lets us measure the passage of time. But the more important feature of time is that some things don't happen over and over again. Some things only happen in one direction, or even if they don't only happen in one direction, they're never quite the same when they come back to where they started. And this aspect of change is what gives time its arrow. And the interesting thing is that that arrow of time, the difference between the past and the future, is nowhere to be found in the fundamental deep-down laws of physics. The fundamental laws of physics are all about repetition and cyclicness and things happening over and over again, but the world around us, time has a direction. What is going on there? So it's the repetition that allows us to measure the passage of time. And what I mean by this is, if you tried to define what you meant by a certain number of minutes passing or a certain number of hours passing, it would always be in terms of something else happening a certain number of times. So we have a clock. We know that every time the Earth rotates around its axis, so the sun comes up, goes down, and then comes up again, the hand on our clock is going to go around 24 times, the minute hand on our clock. The hour hand is going to go around twice because we've chosen to use 12 hours on our clocks. But it's that predictability that makes it possible for us to measure time. So I've drawn some pictures here. If we go time running up from the bottom of the picture to the top, you see one day, then the next day, then the next day. And what happens is that in every interval of time, certain things always happen the same number of times. In one day, the Earth rotates once around its axis. If you have a clock pendulum rocking back and forth 1 second, that's going to happen 864,000 times every day. The reason why quartz clocks are especially good at telling time is because there are little crystals made of quartz that vibrate very, very predictably. Throughout technology, it was always a very difficult project to come up with a clock that was reliable, that worked on the ocean, for example. A pendulum doesn't work very well when there are waves pushing you back and forth. But the little quartz crystal always vibrates the same number of times per second, no matter what the temperature is, no matter what the pressure is, no matter what the motion of the quartz crystal is. So that's how we measure time passing, by comparing one repetitive thing to another repetitive thing. Of course, this also gives us the feeling that time is passing, because within our own bodies, there are repetitive, predictable, cyclic things. Our hearts beat a certain number of times. We breathe at a certain rate. Our central nervous system has signals firing and going back and forth. That's what makes us believe that time is passing and allows us to more or less say, yeah, it's been about 5 minutes since that thing happened, or, gee, isn't this lecture over yet? It feels like a lot longer than an hour. Sometimes, of course, we think that time is passing faster or slower. That's because the rhythms in our body are messing with us. A quartz crystal is really very, very predictable compared to the rotation of the Earth. Our heartbeats and our pulses and our breathing is not quite so predictable. Nevertheless, it can be pretty good enough for certain jobs. There's a wonderful story, and by wonderful I don't necessarily mean true. I'm not sure if the story is true, but it's a really good story, so it should be true, about the young Galileo. Galileo was obviously a crucial figure in the history of physics. He did many wonderful things. Late in life, he got in trouble with the church. Early in life, he was going to church. He was being a good Pisan teenager. He grew up in the city of Pisa, and he went to church in the cathedral right next to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. But nevertheless, the sermon every Sunday isn't always as good as the sermon every other Sunday. Sometimes you get bored. Galileo looked at the chandelier. This is the actual chandelier that still hangs in the cathedral at Pisa, and it was rocking back and forth. And what Galileo noticed, this is why he's Galileo and we're not, we would see, oh yes, that's pretty, chandelier going back and forth. What Galileo notices, some days the chandelier is really rocking, other days it's only moving a little bit, but it seems that when it's really moving a lot, it also moves faster. It's moving physically more meters per second, even though he wouldn't have thought in those terms. So he made a guess. He said, I bet that no matter how broad the oscillation of the pendulum is, it takes the same amount of time to go back and forth. So if it's only rocking back a little bit, it's also moving slowly. If it needs to rock a lot, it needs to move faster so that it completes one oscillation in exactly the same amount of time. Of course, the question is, how do you know? How do you test that? And what Galileo did was he used his own pulse. So while the priest was talking about whatever the priest was talking about that day, I don't want to speculate, Galileo was going 1,000, 2,000 with his pulse, and he noticed that on consecutive Sundays it was true. The chandelier had the same period going back and forth. So there's a repetitive, predictable thing, his pulse, and another repetitive, predictable thing, the chandelier. He was measuring the passage of time. And that principle is still used in grandfather clocks or any other system where we use pendulums going back and forth to measure time. This is, in fact, the physicists love this system of a small pendulum going back and forth. They call it the simple harmonic oscillator, the first thing you learn in any physics class you take in college. Other things, of course, do not repeat themselves. Time passes in ways which are not cyclic. It only happens one way. Human beings change. Some people start out relatively skinny and they puff up a little bit as time goes on, but they remain the king throughout. Austria-Hungary might shrink a little bit after World War I compared to when it was starting in World War I. These are not cyclic phenomena. You never go back to where you started. Your taste in architecture might change. Technology might change. Biological systems change. We grow older with time. The species themselves change. There's biological evolution. These are sort of the interesting aspects of time. Not that things happen over and over again predictably, but some things only happen in one direction. Then they don't go back. So what is the relationship between these two kinds of things? The fact that some things, the systems we use to measure time, need to be predictable and have the same thing happen the same number of times, whereas things around us in our everyday lives change in ways that you never come back. They are irreversible changes. Well, before answering it, let me point out that the universe itself has this property that it is changing in time in an irreversible way. Things within the universe, like stars, have very definite life cycles. Stars start from clouds of gas and dust. They condense, they burn their nuclear fuel, they puff up to become either supernovae or collapse to become smaller stars. But the universe that contains us all also changes in a very definite direction in time. We used to wonder, more than 10 years ago, in fact, we didn't know what the future of the universe was going to be like. Now we more or less have a leading candidate for what the future is going to be like. It is not going to be one in which the universe recollapses. We look around us, and Edwin Hubble, as I'll mention later in the talk, discovered that the universe is expanding with time. The galaxies are moving apart, and already, that's just a remarkable fact, not only about the universe, but about time. The universe is not steady. Even though the universe is large and certainly older than any of us, it is not constant through time. It's changing somehow. So if the universe is expanding, if galaxies are getting further and further apart, we can play that movie backwards. They must have been closer and closer together at earlier times. As soon as you know how fast the galaxies are expanding, you can do a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation and say, well, when were they all on top of each other? And the answer is roughly 10 billion years ago. These days, cosmologists are able to really pinpoint that and say it's 13.7 billion years ago, all the galaxies we see around us were on top of each other. We call that moment the Big Bang. There's a lot we don't know about the Big Bang, and we'll be talking about that also. But one thing we do know is that near the Big Bang in time, everything was on top of everything else. The density of stuff in the universe was amazingly high, much higher than anything we can reproduce here on Earth today. And it's been expanding and cooling ever since then. Things have been moving apart from each other. The universe is becoming more dilute and quieter and colder for the last 13.7 billion years. And it will continue on in the future. We believe that the universe is not going to recollapse. This expansion is going to continue in perpetuity. So this already should be a little bit puzzling because 13.7 billion years seems like a lot of years. But then we have infinity years in front of us. So we're really in the very, very beginning moments of the history of the universe, if this is true. It's not cyclic. We're not going back. Now, through this, there has been developed an explanation for why things change and don't go back that scientists like to refer to, and that's entropy. Entropy is a quality that different systems have that basically, roughly speaking, says how disorderly a system is. So if you have a desk or if you have your office and all the papers are nicely stacked, then the entropy is low. Orderly, nice, organized means low entropy. And you know that if you have a nice organized office and you go away and things happen and you don't try to fight it, it will become more disorderly with time. The entropy will go up. That has been elevated to the status of a law of nature, the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says that if you have a system and it has an entropy, and you leave that system alone, you don't touch it, you don't try to clean things up, the entropy will only ever increase. Entropy only ever goes up, or it could remain constant, but it will never spontaneously go down. So if you leave your office looking like this, and you go away for a few weeks, you don't let anyone come in, and you come back to your office, it's not going to be arranged nice and neatly in orderly piles. That's not going to happen. This is not, by the way, a randomly chosen office. This is the office of Alan Guth, a famous cosmologist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's famous for two things. Number one, he invented the inflationary universe scenario of the beginning of our observable universe. And number two, he won a contest sponsored by the Boston Globe for the messiest office in the greater Boston metropolitan area, as I think that he's just trying to demonstrate the second law of thermodynamics. But there's all these examples of the second law of thermodynamics. Of course, an office getting messy is one of them. An egg breaking is another one. A broken egg has a higher entropy than an unbroken egg. If you take a cup of coffee and you pour milk into it, the entropy goes up as the milk spreads into your coffee. It's easy to get the milk to spread into the coffee. You could wait a long time, it would never unspread out of your coffee. So what is going on here? Why is it that entropy is going up, and what does that mean in terms of the arrow of time? Well, if we look at the deep down laws of physics, we don't see entropy. We don't see the arrow of time. The deep down laws of physics work both ways. But it was Ludwig Boltzmann in the 1870s who finally figured out what entropy really means. We can say, yeah, it has something to do with order or disorder, but what does that really mean? Well, here's an example of irreversibility, the growth of entropy in a system. If you take billiard balls that have been nicely racked in a nice triangular shape, and there's a cue ball, the idea that you could take the cue ball, smack it into the billiard balls, and they would scatter into some random configuration, that makes perfect sense to us. That's how time evolves. The idea that you could take billiard balls that are randomly scattered, hit the cue ball into them, and they could all nicely arrange themselves as if they were racked, that's not going to happen. That's just very, very unlikely. That is an example of entropy in the second law at work. It's not the perfect example because when you hit that cue ball, it's not a closed system anymore. You're prodding it a little bit. But it does uncover what is going on at the deeper level. What is going on is that what entropy is really measuring is the number of ways you can rearrange things. It's measuring how delicately things are ordered. The point is that when you rack the balls on the billiard ball table, there's only one way to rack them like that. But there's lots of ways to be scattered. So when you break, the balls scatter across the table, they look like a mess. If someone else broke the next time you're playing a game, they would be a different mess, but they would still basically look like a mess. There's one way to be racked, there's a lot of messes. There's very small numbers of ways to be low entropy, there are a lot of ways to be high entropy. The puzzle is that the deep down laws of physics don't know about that. If you have a small number of moving parts, you don't see the arrow of time. If you only had two billiard balls, what could possibly happen? They could bump into each other and they could scatter off. But you wouldn't know before or after which was which. There's no such thing as a disorderly arrangement of two billiard balls. And indeed, at a very technical level, you can dig down to the laws of physics and say, did the laws of physics point in any direction of time? And the answer is no. There's no law of physics ever since Isaac Newton, whether it's Newtonian mechanics or Maxwell's electromagnetism or general relativity or superstring theory, they all have the property that at the deep down fundamental level, they're reversible. So in particular, if you took a movie of these two billiard balls smacking into each other, scattering off, then I played that movie backwards, you wouldn't be able to tell me which way was forward, which way was backward. If I play you the movie backwards of all the balls being scattered from a rack when there's many balls on the table, then you know that if they're arranging themselves spontaneously, someone is tricking me with the movie. But with two balls, you would never know that laws of physics at the deep down level, item by item, particle by particle, work equally well forward in time or backwards in time. So here is Boltzmann. This is Ludwig Boltzmann. He passed away. It was a sad story. In 1906, he committed suicide, but he was had already had a tremendous career as a scientist, and this is his tombstone. And his tombstone, unlike most other tombstones, has an equation on it. So that's when you know you've hit the big time as a scientist, when your tombstone has, there's not even any like subscript, you know, there's no gloss or explanation. It's like you're supposed to know what this tombstone is telling you. What it's telling you is what entropy really means. Boltzmann says that what the entropy really is a way to count the number of ways we can take the parts that make up some system and rearrange them so that you wouldn't notice from a macroscopic point of view. It's exactly a way to figure out how many arrangements there are that in some sense it doesn't matter what the arrangement is. So an example is a glass of water with ice cubes in it. Well, what happens in terms of ice cubes and the arrow of time? Ice cubes melt. If you see ice cubes melting and the water just becoming slightly cooler, that's a movie that makes sense. Someone shows you a movie of a glass of water where ice cubes are suddenly forming, you know they're playing it backwards. That's an irreversible process. So what's going on, according to Boltzmann, is that when you have the melted glass with water in it, melted ice cubes in the glass of water, there are many, many ways I could rearrange the individual atoms within that glass of water so that you wouldn't notice. When you look at a glass of water and you say, I know how much water there is, I know its temperature, things like that, I certainly don't know the the position and the velocity of every single atom or molecule in the glass of water. I don't need to know it. But if there's an ice cube, well, then there's water molecules in the ice, and there's water molecules in the liquid water, and they're different. They have a different temperature. I could not switch the ice molecules for the water molecules, even though they're made of the same stuff, because they have different amounts of energy. There are fewer rearrangements I could do when there's a separate cube of ice and liquid water than there are when it's all liquid water. So from that point of view, it's perfectly clear why entropy tends to go up. Entropy counts the number of ways that a system can be rearranged, and therefore, if you start in a state that has a low entropy, it will just naturally move towards higher and higher entropy because there are more ways to be high entropy than to be low entropy. This is a tremendous triumph at a time in the 1870s when physicists, as a field, didn't really like the idea of atoms. They were skeptical about that. Boltzmann and some other people, Maxwell in England and Gibbs in the United States, were championing the idea that when you see gases and things like that, we should think about them in terms of atoms because we can explain things better. Boltzmann's formula for entropy was a classic example of that. He said, as long as you think of entropy as the number of ways you could rearrange a system, then you don't have to work hard to derive the second law of thermodynamics. If you start in a low entropy state, there's not that many ways to be there, you will naturally go to higher entropy. Well, that's good as far as it goes, but it leaves us with a mystery. Entropy increases because there are more ways to be high entropy than low entropy. That explains perfectly well why the entropy will be bigger tomorrow than it is today. But the second law says more than that. It says that it was lower yesterday than it is today. How do you explain that? And Boltzmann and many of his colleagues at the time tore their hair out, and you saw he had a lot of hair, trying to understand why the second law works throughout time. Why can we possibly understand how the entropy was lower yesterday? Well, we know the answer. I can tell you the answer now. It's because it was even lower the day before that, and that goes all the way back to the Big Bang. The reason why entropy has been increasing throughout the entire history of the universe is because it started at the very first moment in an exquisitely low entropy state. That is a fact. That is not something we can derive from the second law itself. It is the input. It is an assumption. We sometimes call this the past hypothesis. Our universe around us started in an exquisitely finely tuned, delicate state of extremely low entropy, and everything since then, for the past 13.7 billion years, has been a gradual increase in entropy, and thank goodness, all of our lives, all of that we experience in our lives is because we live in the aftermath of this very special event. But it still leaves a mystery. Why was the entropy so low in the early universe? Boltzmann could not tell us that. That is a job for cosmology. What was the early universe like and why was it like that? Right now, we do not know the answer, so I'm here to tell you some of the guesses that we've had for what might be going on, but more to impress upon you that this explanation of why ice cubes melt in a glass of water has a part that we don't understand that traces all the way back to the origin of the universe. So here's the universe. This is a picture of the universe taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Someday I will work up enough courage to give an hour-long talk that consists of putting this picture up and then standing in silence for an hour as we all contemplate this picture. We live in a big universe. We live in a galaxy, the Milky Way, with approximately 100 billion stars. The universe contains approximately 100 billion galaxies. So this picture is what you get when you take a sufficiently powerful telescope and point it at a blank region of the sky, a region where you didn't know there was anything there. It will see photons coming from billions of light years away that gradually make this beautiful picture where almost every one of these little blobs is another galaxy with about 100 billion stars. So you can imagine this is why Hubble is looking pretty smug there. He's the one who figured out that all these little blotches are separate galaxies. Before Hubble came along, we didn't know whether the blotches that we saw in the sky were just clouds of gas and dust within our galaxy or separate galaxies on their own right. So once Hubble made his measurements to figure out the distance to some of these galaxies, our view of how big the universe was increased by an enormous amount. The good news is that it doesn't really matter what direction you point your camera in, you're going to get more or less the same picture. Even though the universe is extremely big, full of galaxies, it has the same number of galaxies, roughly speaking, over here and over there. It's very uniform on large scales. So you imagine looking out at night in all directions, you would see 100 billion galaxies spread uniformly through the universe, and it's getting bigger. I already told you that in the early universe, things were squeezed together, more or less on top of each other. In the future, they'll be stretched apart. So as the universe expands, what does that mean? That means that the distance between two galaxies increases and increases with time. The galaxies themselves do not increase as the universe expands because things that are held together by any kind of force are separate from the expansion of the universe. Distant galaxies, which are separate from each other, move apart as the universe expands, but galaxies themselves do not expand. The planet does not expand, an atom does not expand, you are not expanding. Or if you're expanding, it's not because of the expansion of the universe. There are other effects. One thing that does expand is a wave of light. A photon or a light wave traveling through the universe does, in fact, is not held together by any force. It is stretched along with the expansion of space. So short wavelength, high energy photons of light get stretched into long wavelengths, lower energy photons. They go from being blue, low wavelength, to being red, long wavelength. And that's called the redshift of the universe. And that's associated with the cooling down that we also see. The temperature of the universe was incredibly hot at early times. It's very, very low now, 3 degrees above absolute zero. We're about 300 degrees above absolute zero outside right now. So if you trace it all the way back, I cheated a little bit on the slide, said 14 billion. It's really closer to 13.7 billion years ago. Our knowledge gives out. We don't know what happened 13.7 billion years ago. We know that 1 second after 13.7 billion years ago, we can describe the early universe very well, but at t equals zero itself, we're a little bit lost. Another thing we're lost about is right now, the universe is not only expanding, it's expanding faster and faster. This was a recent discovery. In 1998, cosmologists finally had brought together the technology necessary to not only look at the velocity of distant galaxies, but to look at what they thought was going to be their deceleration. If you think about it, galaxies are moving apart with the expanding universe, but they're pulling on each other with their mutual gravitational attraction. So you would have expected that the universe is expanding, but it's expanding more and more slowly as time goes on. So in fact, there was a collaboration, scientific collaboration, called the High Redshift Supernova Team Measuring the Deceleration of the Universe. They went out, the long story worth many talks in its own right, and they came back and said, actually, guys, the universe is accelerating. If you look at a distant galaxy with a certain velocity right now, you measure its velocity very precisely, come back a billion years later, that velocity will be increased. Individual galaxies are moving away from us faster and faster. Why is that? We actually, this is something where it's easy to slip into a language which says, we have no idea whatsoever. But that's not true. We actually have some pretty good ideas. They're not done yet. We don't have the full picture. But the basic idea is there's something called dark energy. And dark energy is just a stand-in for some form of energy which is persistent as the universe expands. So ordinary stuff, remember, it dilutes away. The number of galaxies isn't changing, but the density of galaxies goes down because space increases. The idea of dark energy is that the energy density stays the same. So the amount of energy in a given cubic centimeter doesn't change even as the universe expands. And if it doesn't change very much, the simplest possible version of that is an energy density that doesn't change at all. And we call that specific subset of the dark energy idea vacuum energy. So vacuum energy is really just the idea that if you take a cubic centimeter of space and you remove everything from it, so it's as empty as it can possibly get, there's no dark matter, there's no ordinary matter, there's no photons, neutrinos, etc. And you say, okay, it's an empty cubic centimeter of space. How much energy is there in that empty cubic centimeter? And you might guess, well, it should be zero. There's nothing in there. The answer, according to Einstein and his followers, is actually that's not true. It's an open question. There's a constant of nature, a feature of the laws of physics, which gives us the answer to the question, how much energy is in empty space? And if there's any non-zero answer, there's any little tiny bit of energy in empty space, Einstein says that causes space to expand. And recently, the amount of energy in empty space has taken over. There's more energy of the vacuum energy form in the universe than there is energy in ordinary particles, in ordinary matter, atoms and molecules, and in dark matter, for that matter. And what's going to happen is, therefore, this dark energy is pushing against the universe, causing it to accelerate, causing it to expand faster and faster. That's what gives us some confidence that it's not going to recollapse, because dark energy doesn't go away, as far as we know, and its effect is to make the universe expand faster and faster. There's no returning to the state of the Big Bang, there's definitely an arrow of time in the expansion of the universe from the hot, dense early times to the cold, lonely emptiness of the far future. So be glad that you're here in between when things are hospitable. So the origin of the arrow of time is fundamentally to be found in cosmology. Boltzmann gave us a framework for understanding what it means to have irreversible processes. Entropy goes up because there are more ways to be high entropy than low entropy. But the ultimate fact as to why there was ever low entropy is to be found in the early universe. At very early times, things were extremely smooth. Right now, they're sort of medium smooth. It's true that there are galaxies. The galaxies are smoothly spread throughout the universe. But there's a lot more stuff inside a galaxy than outside the galaxy, so there's a certain lumpiness on medium-sized or small-sized scales. In the early universe, there was essentially no lumpiness. This is an image, this is a snapshot in the bottom right of the universe at about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. This is the cosmic microwave background, the leftover radiation from the moment in the history of the universe where it had cooled off enough to become transparent. Earlier than this, it was so hot that light kept bouncing into electrons running around in the universe. After this point, light could just travel all the way to us. So these particular images that you see here are photons that have been moving through the universe unimpeded for over 13 billion years, only to be unlucky enough to smack into one of our telescopes, in this case, the WMAP satellite telescope from NASA. You see the tiny little fluctuations there that are actually enhanced by a lot for clarity, but these are small differences in temperature of the cosmic microwave background from place to place. Only one part in 100,000. So if you have some square centimeter of space at that time that has 100,000 atoms in it, the square centimeter next to it is going to have 100,001, or 99,999. So there were tiny little variations in the density of the universe from place to place, but they grow with time, because if there were slightly more atoms here than there, that region has a slightly stronger gravitational field and pulls more atoms into it. So the expansion of the universe acts to turn up the contrast knob through the force of gravity. Tiny fluctuations become big fluctuations. These little ripples you see in the microwave background become stars and planets and galaxies that we see today. The universe has become lumpier over the past 14 billion years. Eventually, it's not going to be lumpy anymore. The lumpiness that we have now is going to dissipate. The stars that we have in our galaxy are going to fall into a giant black hole, the center of our galaxy. We already know there is a million solar mass black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. That's not that much. A million solar masses isn't that much in a 100 billion solar mass galaxy. But give it a few more trillion years, all those stars are going to fall into that black hole. But black holes don't sit there forever. Black holes evaporate. So if you wait a Google years, if you wait 10 to the 100 more years from now, all the black holes will have formed and evaporated. There's going to be nothing left in the universe but empty space. So the lumpiness is just a phase we're going through. It's the puberty phase of the universe, but the ultimate age, everything is going to be flat, empty, dilute, cold, nothing going on. Why is it like that? This is the problem. Before telling you why it's like that, let me just impress upon you how important this is that it was like that. Everything that we know about the arrow of time can be traced back to the low entropy of the Big Bang. What does that mean? That means life and death, aging, biological evolution, the fact that you can remember yesterday, but you don't remember tomorrow yet, the fact that we feel that time is flowing around us. There's a whole set of different attributes of what we call the arrow of time, but they all have a common explanation. They're all originally oriented in the second law of thermodynamics, which needs to be explained by invoking the low entropy of the early universe. So this picture is a schematic drawing of the Earth and the Sun, not to scale. In real life, the Sun is bigger than the Earth. But the point is, it's supposed to get across the fact that if entropy were high, if we were not in this weird universe, if you were in a maximally disorganized universe, we would call that equilibrium. Everything would be the same everywhere. It'd be like the glass of water where the ice cubes had melted. Everything would be spread out and smooth. And then there'd be nowhere to go. If entropy is high, it would just stay high forever and ever. Nothing interesting would ever happen. The only reason why anything interesting ever happens in the universe is because we are nowhere near equilibrium, because entropy is much lower than it could possibly be. And the most important manifestation of that is the sun in the sky. In equilibrium, things are smooth and spread out. So when you look at the sky, it would look the same everywhere. That's not what we actually see when we look at the sky. We have the sun, which is a bright, hot spot in a very cold, empty sky. And it's because of that arrangement that everything around us is possible. The Earth receives energy from the sun, as you know. It also gives off energy back to the universe around it. It might not be immediately obvious, but the amount of energy we get from the sun is almost exactly equal to the amount of energy we give out to the universe. Otherwise, the Earth would be heating up. It is heating up, by the way, just a little bit. That's a problem, but not a problem for this talk. To my approximations, we give off the same amount of energy as we receive, but not the same amount of entropy. It turns out that for every photon we get from the sun, the Earth radiates 20 photons into space around it. That's 20 times the entropy. We are able to gain a tremendous amount of entropy just by processing the energy we get from the sun. We get useful energy in a low entropy form from the sun. We give it off in a high entropy useless form to the rest of the universe, and that powers the plants that fed the dinosaurs that died and turned into oil and lets us get in our car and move around. Everything that happens here on Earth is because the sun is a hot spot in a cold sky. That's ultimately a low entropy configuration, which is allowed because the Big Bang had a low entropy. And this includes, this whole chain of logic includes not only biological scientific sounding things, it includes things like causality, cause and effect, the idea that we have a free will that lets us make choices about the future. This is all because of the arrow of time. If you think about an egg, you see the egg broken on a sidewalk somewhere, and you ask yourself, what might happen over the next 24 hours to that egg that is broken on the sidewalk? And you say, well, I don't know, lots of things. It could sit there, it could bake or freeze depending on the temperature, someone could go clean it up, a dog could come by and eat the egg or something. It's just a lot of different possible things. But then if you say, well, what do you think the last 24 hours of the egg were like? You were like, well, probably 24 hours ago, it was an unbroken egg. You can be much more specific about what could possibly happen to that egg if you think about what happens in the past than in the future. Why is that? Because we're making an assumption. We're making the past hypothesis. We're assuming that we start in an extremely low entropy state. If you didn't make that assumption, you wouldn't be able to say any different thing about what the past of that egg was like than about the future. Likewise, for any decisions you make in your life, our feeling that the past is finished, put in the books, unretrievable, irrevocable, unchangeable, is not anywhere to be found in the laws of physics. According to the laws of physics, the past and the future are equally real, equally determined, etc., etc. The difference in the real world is that the past is hamstrung by the fact that it has to connect to a low entropy boundary condition. So the fact that you think you can change your mind about what to have for dinner tomorrow night, but not what you did have dinner about last night, is because of the arrow of time. So to understand it, we need to understand the Big Bang. There's various possibilities, and here's where I go from saying things that are true to wondering what might be true. From here on in, I don't know what is right and what is wrong. We're going to explore some different possibilities. My own biases will come through very clearly. So I'm going to suggest three different possible scenarios. All of them are pretty much on the table. One is that the Big Bang just was special. It was the beginning of the universe. By the way, this wouldn't have been an option to Ludwig Boltzmann in the 1870s. He didn't know about the expanding universe, he didn't know about the Big Bang, etc. But these days, in fact, since we figured out that the universe is expanding in the 1920s, it seems very clear to us that, okay, there's a place where we can hide all of the mystery of the low entropy of the early universe. There's the Big Bang. We don't know what happened at the Big Bang. Stephen Hawking might know, or someone else might know, but maybe there's just a law. Maybe there's an extra principle of physics that says, at early times, the entropy was extremely low. In fact, there's a specific implementation of this idea that is related to the idea of inflation I talked to you just earlier about. Alan Guth, cosmologist at MIT, suggested a way to help explain why the universe around us is so smooth and homogeneous. Remember, we have this tens of billions of light years across universe with 100 billion galaxies in it that looks more or less the same everywhere. That seems very delicately tuned. Why couldn't it be different here than there? So what Alan Guth pointed out was, he said, well, imagine there was a very, very tiny region in the very early universe that was dominated, that was full of an incredibly high temporary form of dark energy. Remember, dark energy doesn't go away as the universe expands. It makes the universe accelerate, but only very, very gently. If you had a temporary form of dark energy that was very virulent, that had an extremely high amount of energy, it would make the universe accelerate at a tremendous rate. So Guth assumed that you had just a really tiny region, much, much less than a centimeter across, dominated by dark energy, and that stretched to a tremendous size. And that stretching smoothed everything out, like pulling at the edges of a wrinkled sheet, making it very, very smooth. And then, by some miracle, the dark energy went away. It turned into ordinary matter and radiation, and we see the aftermath of that as the Big Bang. This idea is inflation, and it has been subscribed to, has been the dominant paradigm in cosmology since Guth came up with it in the early 1980s. It solves the problem of why the universe looks so smooth. The problem is, as far as entropy is concerned, it's a disaster. It does not tell us why the early universe had a low entropy, except by the logic that it had a low entropy because the entropy was even lower before that. That little patch from which the universe came had an extraordinarily low entropy. And the way to think about that is, everything you see around us today, in this room, the rest of the Earth, the galaxy, the 100 billion galaxies around us, all that stuff was in that little patch. It was implicit there, but the degrees of freedom, the physical system from which we came, were very, very delicately arranged so that everything we see around us could fit smoothly into that little patch. There aren't that many arrangements of the degrees of freedom of the universe that would make that happen. That's an extremely low entropy, finely tuned configuration. So inflation might be right. I'm the kind of person who thinks that inflation has a lot going for it. It might be on the right track. But it doesn't tell us why the early universe had a low entropy. It demands that we understand better than we do now why the early universe was like that. The next idea is a cool one, and it actually does go back to Boltzmann. It says, well, maybe the universe is just the kind of thing that happens from time to time. It's a very appealing idea. It sort of removes us from any specialness. But it doesn't work. So I want to tell you, even before I go into what it means, is it doesn't work. So it's not. This is the one I think I can say with some confidence is not right. But the reason why it's interesting is because the words that Boltzmann uses when he thinks about this idea are the same words that cosmologists use today when they talk about the multiverse, when they talk about the anthropic principle, when they talk about the idea that the universe we see around us is just a tiny little part of a much bigger system. We think that's all avant-garde and new stuff. Boltzmann was talking about that over 100 years ago. So here's a quote from Boltzmann going back to 1895. What he imagined, remember, he didn't know general relativity, quantum mechanics, etc. He thought Newton was right. He imagined a universe full of particles, like on the diagram on the left here. And he says, look, if you wait long enough, since I'm Boltzmann and I know what entropy is, the entropy can, in fact, occasionally go down, even though the second law says it goes up, because if you wait long enough, there will be fluke fluctuations. It will just so happen that all the particles will bunch up in one region of occasionally lower entropy, and they will move back. They will relax. And Boltzmann says, maybe that's the universe. Maybe that is everything around us. So there must be then in the universe, which is in thermal equilibrium as a whole and therefore dead. So he's saying, by the way, life could not exist if we were in thermal equilibrium. Here and there, relatively small regions the size of our galaxy, which we call worlds, which during the relatively short time of eons deviate significantly from thermal equilibrium. So this is Boltzmann's multiverse. It's a huge region, infinitely big, full of molecules at some temperature. They're moving around, randomly arranging themselves, and occasionally they fluctuate into a very low entropy state. We are in the aftermath of that little fluctuation coming back to a high entropy state. Why are we there rather than the background? Well, because we can live here. There's a selection effect. We can live in a region of the universe where the entropy is increasing. We can't live in thermal equilibrium. So he wasn't the first to come up with this. The first idea I could trace it back to was 50 BC. Lucretius, a poet in the early Roman Empire, a follower of Epicurus and Democritus, just like Boltzmann, Lucretius was an atomist at a time when most people were not atomists. And he was faced with the same kinds of problems. He was trying to explain how we could get all this order and all this structure that we see around us in the universe if it's really just atoms bumping into each other. So he says, surely the atoms did not hold counsel, assigning order to each, flexing their keen minds with questions of place and motion and who goes where. Instead, they jumbled and shuffled in many ways in the course of endless time. They are buffeted, driven along, chancing upon all motions, combinations. At last, they fall into such an arrangement as would create this universe. It's exactly Boltzmann's idea. Lucretius had fewer equations than Boltzmann did, but he's attacking the same problem. How can the mindless shuffling of random atoms create all this wonderful stuff we see around us? And he says, well, if you wait long enough, it's just the kind of thing that's going to happen from time to time. This scenario, the Boltzmann-Lucretius scenario for our low entropy early universe, does not work. Why doesn't it work was pointed out at least by Arthur Eddington in the 1930s. It might have been pointed out before that, but I haven't been able to find a reference. And the problem is that if you are Boltzmann and you do have his equations, you know that it is true that fluctuations happen. If you're at maximum entropy, equilibrium, everything's smooth, occasionally you'll go to lower entropy. But usually you'll go to lower entropy a little bit, and then you'll smooth out again. It's much, much more rare to have a huge fluctuation of entropy than a tiny fluctuation of entropy. So Eddington said, so the punchline of this is that this scenario, that we're a fluctuation in a thing that is usually in thermal equilibrium, makes an incredibly strong prediction, and that prediction can be compared against data and it comes out false. The prediction is that we are the smallest possible fluctuation in entropy that is allowed by, and then you tell me what it needs to be allowed by. So if you put any condition, say, such that human beings exist, such that the Earth exists, Eddington says that the correct anthropic criterion is such that there are mathematical physicists, and you make a prediction that you are the smallest possible fluctuation in entropy consistent with that criterion. So he says, it is practically certain that at any assigned date, the universe will be almost in a state of maximum disorganization. A universe containing mathematical physicists, blah, 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 will be in a state of maximum disorganization, which is not inconsistent with the existence of such creatures. So, if I really believed this scenario, and I said, well, I know that you guys are all here right now, and I know that I'm here in this room, I can see it, so I'm going to trust my senses, believe that this room is here, and I believe this scenario, and that includes, by the way, all my memories, all my records, all my thoughts about the laws of physics and the laws of nature and logic. I say, what do I predict? What I predict is that when I open the door and go outside, it will be thermal equilibrium. Everything will be exactly the same. There'll be no cars, there'll be no Waterloo, there'll be no TV stations, et cetera, et cetera. That is a prediction that is ruled out all the time. And in fact, you can go to the reductio ab absurdum and say, who needs you? And I just need me. And in fact, who needs me? I just need my brain, because that's where all the thoughts are going on. So this reduces us to the idea of Boltzmann brain. That if we were really in a universe which is mostly in thermal equilibrium with occasional fluctuations, almost all of the conscious thinking observers in that large multiverse would be disembodied brains that had randomly fluctuated out of the thermal background and then come back. It's much, much easier to do that than to create the whole universe and have the brain be a small, comfortable part of that. That is the argument that says this Boltzmann-Lucretius scenario cannot be right. Our universe is not a low entropy fluctuation within a high entropy background. So, this is true. I believe this, you should believe it. However, not everyone believes it. So this picture here came from an article in the New York Times about this scenario, and I was quoted in the article, and afterward, I received a little piece of fan mail. This is from George Wing, 10 years old, who was very agitated by this article. And I will read, it's hard to translate. George is very excited, so I will translate what his letter says. I don't know if you exist, but I do. I do not agree with your article, and I do not believe that mumbo-jumbo. If you do, well, it's a disturbing thought, but I know how to deal with it. I will not let the world disappear under my nose, but if you do, I can't say I'm sorry. Sincerely, a 10-year-old who knows a little more than some people, George Wing. P.S. Some people have a little too much time. So I'm looking forward, he's 10 years old, 10 years from now when George is applying to Caltech, I'm going to blackball his application because I don't want any people like that giving me attitude. It's difficult to accept because when we talk about Boltzmann brains, it sounds like we're suggesting that we really could be a brain popping out of nothingness. And it is true, I am suggesting that, but the point is that the alternative being suggested by this scenario is that the universe is popping out of nothingness, and that's even less likely than a brain popping out of nothingness. Therefore, this scenario is probably not right. So if those two scenarios are not right, I mean, the first one could very well be right. It could just be there's an extra law of physics. I don't like it. It seems like a cop-out to me. It seems like instead of answering the question, we're saying, yeah, that's a good question, and then moving on to something else, and that's a traditional cosmological attitude toward the problem. I want to do better than that. The second attempt is at least an attempt to do better than that, but we also have the third possibility, which is that the Big Bang is not the beginning of the universe, but it's also not just thermal equilibrium. Something existed before the Big Bang that explains where we came from. After all, you see eggs in the universe, even though eggs are low entropy. You could ask yourself, well, why are there any eggs in the universe if all this babble that things want to be high entropy is right? Why are there eggs? And the answer is, the egg is not a closed system. There was a chicken. that helped create the egg. So could there be a universal chicken? Could there be something from which our universe was created in its relatively low entropy state? And keep in, notice that the chicken is not an intelligent designer. The chicken is not like putting together the proteins in the egg. It happens through very naturalistic processes. We want to know, are there equations, are there dynamical rules governing stuff in the universe from which there could have been a prior state out of which our universe came? Now, you've probably heard that, in fact, the Big Bang is the beginning of space and time. This is a common thing that cosmologists tell people all the time. They say, they say the Big Bang, what is going on, what happened before the Big Bang, and you're told by very, very well-meaning and highly educated cosmologists, there was no such thing as before the Big Bang. The Big Bang was the beginning of everything. There was no prior moment. Both space and time came into existence. At that moment, if you've gone this long in your life without hearing that before the Big Bang is like being north of the North Pole, then congratulations to you, because that's what you hear most of the time. But it might not be true. In fact, it's very, very inaccurate to say that we have a good reason to think that that is true. That is an extrapolation beyond where the currently known and understood laws of physics allow us to go. What is actually true is that as you go back to the early universe, using laws of physics as we know them, you don't hit a moment of time before which there was no time. You hit a point where your equations aren't good anymore. Einstein, here's a picture of Einstein. Now, you usually see pictures of Einstein with the gray hair and the rumpled sweatshirt and so forth, late in life. But when Einstein was doing his great stuff, special relativity, general relativity, things like that, in the early, this is 1912, I believe, he was a sharp-dressed young man. Someone was combing his hair. I don't know what was going on, but he was clearly a smart guy, a little bit on the ball, figured out how space and time worked. But his theory, general relativity, which explains gravity as the curvature of space-time, is incomplete. We know it can't be right because it's inconsistent with itself. General relativity predicts its own downfall because it predicts there should be places and times where the equations of general relativity don't apply. Those moments are singularities, places where things that should be finite numbers become infinite, and the Big Bang is one of them. So the correct thing to say about the Big Bang is not that there was no time before it, it's that our current understanding of the laws of physics gives out at that moment in time. We need to think a little bit harder. We should be open-minded. It could have been the beginning, or it could have been a phase through which the universe goes. So the way that I like to think about this, asking, well, what kind of configuration could the universe have come from, is to think about the second law of thermodynamics. The second law says, well, entropy goes up as we go from unnatural states to natural states. We don't understand entropy when gravity is concerned because we don't know the space of all the possible states. That's the problem of quantum gravity. We don't know how to marry together quantum mechanics and general relativity yet. So one possible attitude is to throw up your hands and say, I don't know what to do. Another one is to say that even if I don't know what entropy is, I know what's happening to the universe. I know where it's going. I know what it's going to look like in the future. And if it's true that entropy is going up, I can infer what a high entropy state looks like just by asking what the universe will in fact look like billions of years into the future. Well, we know what's going to happen. It's going to look like empty space. The universe is becoming more and more dilute. Things are emptying out. Distant galaxies are receding away from us. Eventually, the stars will collapse into black holes. The black holes will evaporate. We'll be left with nothing but empty space. But as we know, we think that empty space now has energy in it, vacuum energy, a tiny, tiny fraction of an erg in every cubic centimeter of space. And what that means is that if empty space has energy in it, it also has a temperature. That even if you're in perfectly empty space, if you sit there with a thermometer, you will detect stuff around you. Your thermometer will detect a non-zero temperature. That means that there are fluctuations, that empty space is not a quiet place. And this is just one of the miracles of quantum mechanics, that you can't pin down empty space to perfect quietude. There's always little ripples, there's always little fluctuations. It could be that one such fluctuation makes a new universe. So the natural place for the universe to be is in a high entropy state. That's empty space, nothing there but vacuum energy. But these fluctuations could conspire in a special way. That number one, space-time itself fluctuates into a funny shape where you have a throat connecting a bulbous region of space-time. And then the fields that make up space could fluctuate inside to make, guess what, a super dense region of dark energy that is ready to undergo inflation. So in other words, we have a mechanism which we can at least draw pictures. There's some equations also, but this is a not fully finished story yet. But it could be that you go from empty space, very, very quiet, to creating a little part of space that is disconnected, branches off, and becomes a baby universe. This little patch, this little tiny little thing, according to Alan Guth's theory, will expand and become a universe just like ours. So the reason why this is an interesting story is because it can explain why you go from emptiness to a universe that is alive like ours. You start with a universe that is perfectly quiet, no arrow of time, you're in thermal equilibrium, it's empty space, nothing is going on. But every now and then, if you start in the middle of this picture and move to the right, what's happening are that baby universes are created very, very, very rarely, but they grow up and they have their own entropy, and the total entropy of the universe increases through that mechanism. But our universe, it could be one of those baby universes, but not the only one. We could have our own babies in the future, that we could have siblings next to us. Furthermore, if again you start in the middle and go to the left, the same story will be told. So according to this picture, there's the reason why the universe has entropy that is increasing around us is because the universe can always increase in entropy. There is no configuration it could be in where the entropy would max out and stop moving. You thought you were there with empty space, but even empty space can make more entropy by making more universes. And the overall multiverse that has all this stuff going on in it is actually symmetric. The past looks like the future. These separate universes, far, far in the past, have an arrow of time that is pointing in the opposite direction. The bad news is that we can't talk to them, we can't really converse with them, we don't know that they're there by any experimental means, but it's a story that fits together. The question is the story right? I don't know. So what I did is I wrote a book about it. Writing a book is sort of the last refuge of a scoundrel as far as science is concerned. If I really knew the answer, I'd write a paper and it would be refereed, etc. But the answer is not the important thing here. The thing I want to emphasize is not my particular favorite scenario for answering this. Well, what I want to emphasize is this is a really important puzzle that connects things that goes on in our kitchen to the very early universe, and it's a puzzle we are not close to having the right answer to yet. So what we know is that entropy is responsible for the arrow of time. All of those different manifestations of the difference between the past and the future are reflections of the second law of thermodynamics, all that stuff. The reason why entropy is increasing is because it was very low to start with in the early universe. And number three, we don't know why it was low. So one of the things we know is that we do not know why the entropy was very low in the early universe. The speculative part is, were they initial conditions? Were they all special? Were they all by themselves? Or did we come from something else? Did we come from a bigger universe? I don't know the answer. We're working on it hard. I think we're close to the point in time when science has finally got its act together and we can approach these questions scientifically. And I'm hoping that at the 20th anniversary of the Premier Institute, 10 years from now, you'll come back and I'll give you the answer to all these questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean. We have time for some questions. So please come on out to the aisle on your right and come on down to the front and pose your questions. While you're on your way down, I have some questions from online. So the first question is Oscar from Montreal asks, at what speed is the universe expanding?
This is a very good question. At what speed is the universe expanding? A very good question means I know the answer. But in this case, there is no answer. If you look at a galaxy far away in the universe, the galaxy has a speed at which it is apparently moving away from us right now. But if you look at a different galaxy, it has a different speed. There's no one speed we can attach to the expansion of the universe because different parts of the universe appear to be moving away from us at different speeds, and that has always been true and that always will be true. The universe has a rate of expansion. It has a number of years it will take for the universe to double in size. And so it's approximately 10 billion years. So the best answer to that is that every 10 billion years or so, the universe gets twice as big.
Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for your talk, Sean. My name is Nick. I'm a postdoc in quantum information here. And I have two brief questions. One is my perspective on thermodynamics is more from a Bayesian perspective, a la Jaynes. And the first question is, do your arguments about low entropy at the beginning still hold in that picture? And if so, what changes? And the other was related to the Sir Arthur Eddington point that you made, which was that random fluctuations, well, I didn't quite get the whole thing, but what I wanted you to address was how would natural selection or some sort of computational process occur? Because what I was thinking is maybe there's a fluctuation that was sufficient to create initial conditions that would then allow the natural selection to take over.
Great, okay, so two questions. The first question I'm not going to answer in a way that will keep you happy. Let me just say something about the bigger picture there. So I talked about entropy and I gave you a definition of entropy. It's the definition that is engraved on Boltzmann's tombstone, S equals K log W in equations. This is one way of defining what the entropy is. There are other ways, as you referred to. There's different definitions of entropy, there's different definitions of probability, there are different ways of putting things together. My claim is that even though there are all these different definitions of entropy, different ways of doing probability, et cetera, the way that I talked about here is the right one to use for this particular problem. So you can have different insights, different calculational techniques that are appropriate for different kinds of problems that we can solve, but I think that the real question of the early universe, you can phrase without using entropy. The early universe was in a very special state. One way of saying it is the following. If you took our universe today and made exactly the same kind of universe, but then it collapsed, okay, ran the movie backwards, the answer that you get after the universe collapses looks nothing at all like our actual early universe. That is a phenomenological, physical, down-to-earth statement, and I think that's the problem no matter what formalism you use. The second question about complexity and so forth is really just one of overcoming your feelings about how things work in the real world. So we have the Boltzmann-Lucretius scenario, in which the universe is a box of gas. Okay, it's a really, really big box of gas, and occasionally things fluctuate randomly, and then they bounce back, and they say, well, maybe that's the whole universe. And then you say, no, that can't be right, because if that were right, you would just form small pockets of low entropy, not big pockets of low entropy. And then someone comes up and says, but wait, to get a brain, or let's make it a little bit less anthropocentric, to get a pumpkin pie, I need, like, pumpkins and a farmer and sugar and things like that. So isn't there some condition that says I'm just not going to get brains or human beings or whatever I want unless I have this huge fluctuation in entropy? I think the answer is just no. That's actually not true. That if you take a pumpkin pie and no other assumptions, in particular no past hypothesis that tells you the universe started in a low entropy state, and say, what is the easiest way to get that pumpkin pie? It's a fluctuation out of thermal equilibrium, out of a random collection of things that just happen to make a pumpkin pie. It is not, and why isn't it easier to go through a pumpkin? Well, the pumpkin is much lower entropy than the pumpkin pie, and it's harder to fluctuate into the pumpkin. So we're not used to thinking of this way, in this way, because we're so used to how things work in the real world, where we have this flow from low entropy to high entropy. But if you don't assume that from the start, almost everything you see around you is more likely to have come from a random fluctuation than from an orderly series of things, no matter how complicated, complex, evolutionary it seems.
Thank you.
Next person would like to come down, ask a question.
Thank you very much. This was a great lecture. I still have some questions. My name is Frank Chachra. I live in Waterloo. My question is also twofold. Number one, you know, you talked, and everybody talks about time, you know, time does this and that and goes in arrow and so and so. I like to know, can you give me a definition of time? Not what time does and what it is, just the definition of time.
Let's just have one question, actually, at a time. Just one question
okay?
at a time, please. That
okay,
would be good. Yes.
That's fine.
Great. So the question is, what is the definition of time? And I will resist saying by my book, but I will give you the answer that is found therein. And the point is that we use the word time to mean different things. And so one definition, and it's not that one definition is right and one is wrong, it's just they're useful for different purposes. One definition of time is that it's a coordinate on space-time. The time is a mile marker. It helps us find things in the universe. It is the thing that lets us say, let's meet at the cafe tomorrow at 5 p.m., okay? It's a set of imaginary clocks spread throughout the universe. We could spread them in different ways, but that's one way of thinking about time. Another way of thinking about time is that time is what clocks measure. That if you have something which you think is repeatable, predictable, and reliable, and it, you know that every so often it does something, then the number of things that it does throughout its history as it moves through space-time is a measure of time. There are other definitions, but those two get you pretty far.
Well, the next person's coming down. I might bring one other question from online. A viewer from Burlington, Ontario says, recent biology research has shown it may be possible to slow aging by severe deprivation of oxygen, so time slows down for that person's relative point of view. So does that finding have any implications in the physics research you're talking about, the human perception?
Good. So my claim was that this idea of the arrow of time reflected by or originating in the second law of thermodynamics, the increase of entropy, shows up in all sorts of different ways. So there is a feeling that intuitively what it means is that things sort of decay and fall apart. You know, your office gets messier, it doesn't get cleaner. And this happens at the cell level in biology, or even at the molecular level. It turns out that when you clone the sheep, the cloned sheep are not, in fact, even at the DNA level, perfect replicants of the parent sheep. They change a little bit from generation to generation. They get worse and worse, just like in that terrible Michael Keaton movie. So we would like to stop this. Our individual bodies are decaying. We are aging. We would like to slow it down. That is something you can try to do. In fact, there are legitimate efforts to reverse the arrow of time at the molecular level. And I would say that it has absolutely nothing to do with fundamental physics or the questions that we've been addressing here, because these systems are nowhere near closed systems. You're taking a little molecule, you're trying to make it younger than it used to be by training on it all of this machinery that you've highly put together in a very, very coordinated way. It would not happen by itself. The entropy of the whole universe still is going up as that is happening. So I love this research into reversing or delaying the march of time in biological systems, but it's completely consistent with everything we said here about entropy in the second law.
Next person, please.
Thank you, Dr. Kell. Appreciate your lecture tonight. Very, very nice, very, very well done. At the expense of possibly attaining a rank lower than Mr. Wing, I'd like to ask just one question. I've always had a question about the idea that time itself, we have a psychological basis of time, and it seems to always be that which is plugged into space at its inception from Einstein and even before with Galileo. And as such, I was just curious about if we can separate that and talk more of its physics and the physical aspects of time, such as in space, we might take a three-dimensional aspect, put it to the usual metric and get length. Can we do the same with time and possibly talk about its dimensions if that's a possibility, and then talk about its usual Euclidean metric being the time that we sense psychologically?
Yeah, no, I think these are very, very good issues that are all certainly entangled with each other, because if I kept listing definitions of time to the previous question, the next thing I would have gone to is that time is something we experience as human beings. We have this feeling of it. There is a psychological dimension. There's a whole set of interesting questions. When I say that the arrow of time is a reflection of the second law of thermodynamics, so all these different things, metabolism, life, death, memory, blah, 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 it's all because of the second law. That is a true statement. Do we know how it works? No. We don't always know how the increase of entropy is reflected in biological evolution, the aging of an individual human being, the way that we accumulate memories about the past, we need to make predictions of the future. This is all work in progress and incredibly important stuff. So I think that there is a physical notion of time, physics in the physical sense of physics, that is we understand very, very well in physics what time is. We don't understand some of its features, namely why the early universe had a low entropy. Then there's separately from that psychological aspects, because we psychologically are made of atoms, we're part of the natural world, but we are highly complicated parts of the natural world. We have impressions that go on in our conscious minds about time passing, and figuring all that out is a very, very good project.
Next question.
Hello, I'm Laura Lamont, and I'm from Kitchener.
Can you just come a little closer? Thank you.
I'm Laura Lamont, and I'm from Kitchener. And I'm interested in the relationship between time and temperature. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that as you approach 0 degrees Kelvin, molecular movement is much slower. And as you increase with temperature, movement increases in speed. And I was just wondering how this affects the passage of time on a larger scale.
So a very good question once again. Remember that time is something that we measure. Time is what clocks measure, is one of the definitions. So what if you mess with your clocks? One kind of clock is a molecule or an atom in a particular configuration that is vibrating backwards and forwards. So like you say, if you take a collection of molecules and cool them off, make them colder and colder, there are various processes within that collection of molecules that slow down, that seem to go slower and slower. So the cheap answer to your question is, well, that's not a very good clock. If you have a clock that changes the rate at which it's ticking as you change the temperature, then that's not what you should put in your wristwatch. But there's sort of a more complicated answer, which is that if we define time by saying that there exist in the universe all of these repetitive things that are reliable in the number of times one thing happens compared to the number of times something else happens, what if there's some sense in which that's never exactly true? You know, how do you measure time absolutely compared to something else? We think that atomic processes in individual atoms, governed by the laws of quantum mechanics, with an individual atom, that the clicking of an atomic clock at the fundamental level is absolutely reliable. But that's not set in stone. We have theories where, for example, the charge of the electron slowly varies with time. And if that were true, then even individual atomic processes would not be completely reliable. And this goes all the way to novels, like Nicholson Baker had a novel called The Fermata. And in his novel, the protagonist had the ability to freeze time for everyone else in the universe except for him. And he used this mostly to be a peeping Tom. He was not actually very lofty about what he used this superpower for. But the point is, so you can ask yourself, in that universe, what is time really? Is it his time? Did time speed up for him, or did it slow down for everyone else? And of course, you quickly realize it makes no sense because he'd be blind. There couldn't be any light coming from him because the time from the light bulb has stopped, and so the photon is not moving anymore. So I think that's just a very, very long-winded way of saying that's a really good question, and it depends on the details. Yeah.
Thank you, anyway.
Next question, please.
Hi there, my name is Phil. I'm not a postdoc or smart, but I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how we can sensibly talk about a sense of time divorced from human experience itself. Someone like Kant would say that time is just an inner intuition, a way that we make sense of the manifold of reality. So how is it that we're talking about time divorced from our own experience of it?
Good, so the question is, can we, you know, if a clock ticks in the woods and there's no one there to look at it, does time pass? Is there time passing even if there weren't any human experience of it? So I think I'm probably going to give an answer that doesn't really quite respect the question as much as it should, but I'm going to say, sure, time can pass when I'm not there. I leave my watch in the drawer at night, it is ticked off, it shows a different time when I come back. I'm a physicist, and so I think that the first two definitions I gave, time is a coordinate on space-time. In John Wheeler's formulation, time is what keeps everything from happening at once. And number two, time is what clocks measure, and clocks are going to keep measuring and ticking off even when I'm not there. I think that both of those are perfectly respectable, well-defined definitions of what time is that need absolutely no human psychological intervention to exist. So I think that what Kant is actually doing is pointing out that there's another concept of time that is tied to our psychology, and the interesting thing is not whether one is right or one is wrong, but what is the relationship between these different notions of what time really is.
We have time for perhaps one more question. I'll bring in one other question from online. That is sort of related to an earlier one about the speed of the expansion of the universe. The question is, what's happening at the very edge of the universe? Is it expanding faster than the speed of light? This is Ken from Toronto who wants to know.
Good. Another good question by the previous definition of good question. What is happening at the edge of the universe? So this is another area where cosmologists, bless their hearts, some of my best friends are cosmologists, but sometimes they will tell you things that they really don't have any right to be talking about. So they will tell you that our universe stretches uniformly forever and ever. We're not sure about that. We can only see part of the universe. The fact is that we can't see past whatever happened at the Big Bang. We're looking backwards in time when we look out at distant things because light moves at a finite speed. And if anyone asks you what the speed of light is, it's one light year per year. So in a 14 billion year old universe, roughly speaking, you can see back about 14 billion light years. That's not exactly right, because the universe is expanding, but that's basically there. So there's an edge to what we can see. And so cosmologists will straighten up a little bit and go, ha. But in fact, that's not really an edge, because the universe is uniform. Even if we can't see it, there's still just as much stuff beyond what we can see as there is here. It's smooth. The truth is,
Sean, if we can be smooth. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Just a quick answer.
Time and space. Sadly, there's no edge to the universe. Outside what we can see, things might go on forever just like that, or they might be radically different. We just don't know.
Well. Thanks very much for being here, everybody. Our next event is on tomorrow morning. For details, have a look at our website, q2cfestival.com. And, well, let's thank Sean one more time for that wonderful talk. Thank you.